This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Dream Teams, working together without falling apart. This is the author, Shane Snow. The foreword is written and read by Aaron Walton.
Forward by Aaron Walton, activist, model, and founding partner of Walton Isaacson. This is Aaron Walton. When I was in third and fourth grade, my grandfather used to ask me, "What will you do today to make the world a better place?" Every morning when I saw him, I knew that's what he was going to ask me. Growing up a gay black kid in Massachusetts in the 1960s and 70s, was not the easiest. I was in Roxbury, a rough part of Boston. But every single time I saw him, Pops would ask me the exact same thing. Not what will you do today to make your life better, but what will you do today to make the world better? And I've got to tell you, I remember thinking, that's part of my job. On my journey, I became very aware of the massive power that working as a team has to make something bigger and better than just myself. Because of how I grew up, I've always felt the need to be a leader and to help move things along. But I also realized that progress is not a solo journey. That philosophy has been how I've approached everything. For example, when I started my latest company, my partner Corey and I sat down with an ambitious mission. What if we wanted to create the planet's most interesting agency, we said. When we sat down and mapped it out, the first thing that we worked on was not what clients we would go after, what creative work we would do. Those are typical things that agencies start with. Instead, the question we asked ourselves was what team of people will be able to reach this vision. We decided that if we got the right kinds of different people in the room and we tapped into their unique points of view, that would be what got us there. We believed that ideas could be pushed forward in a more productive and innovative way if you have a team of people with diverse backgrounds. And not just culturally diverse, but also by discipline. I knew the research that shows that teams like these can be more successful because different people have to work harder to get their points across. When we're with people who aren't like us, we have to marshal more resources and brain power to help convince other people of why a different direction might be the right direction. And this helps us break through. Over the years, we've put this into practice. And we've built a team that is truly different and truly does have some of the planet's most interesting work, furthering social causes while building businesses at the same time. When we pitched and won a Super Bowl campaign, for example, we weren't successful just because of the idea. When we made a viral video showcasing Hispanic Americans taking pride in their work and heritage, it didn't go viral just because of the concept itself. There are billions of great ideas. It was how our team worked together that made these things happen. It was about how we brought that great idea to life by tapping into the zeitgeist of the people in our group. Real innovation comes from our differences. Ideas get better when we challenge each other. But here's the thing. It's not comfortable. It's messy. It's like a Pollock painting. It looks like chaos. As humans, we want to avoid conflict. The tension points between us make us better. But getting it to work right is hard. That's why I'm excited about this book. I think we're much stronger collectively than we are individually. If you think about every great breakthrough in the world, it's genuinely linked to when people have been working as a team. When we've been thinking about, what can we do that's going to make life better for someone else? Am I naive to think that that's the way the world should work? We're all trying to get to our mountaintop. And once we get to it, we're looking for another mountain to climb. To make that journey, we need each other. The answer to my grandfather's question will be different every day for each of us. The fact that we need to do it together will not. And when we win, we'll all win.
Incipitus prologus. Dream teams. At the height of the Cold War, the Soviet Union and the collective nations known as the West competed over practically everything. Politics, technology, chess, math, going to space. But there was one arena in which there was no competition. Hockey. The Soviets owned that one. Between 1960 and 1990, the Soviet national hockey team won nearly every international match it played. And that's the dullest way to put it. The Russians destroyed. In the 1976 Olympics, for example, they trounced the United States 6-2, mopped up Finland 7-2, and beat Czechoslovakia in the finals for the Olympic gold medal. Their fourth gold medal in a row. The Soviet coach was a freak, a legend, a Zen master on ice. Anatoly Tarasov was his name. He made his young athletes study chess and dancing. They practiced jumping off walls. They learned to do ninja moves wearing skates. They sang songs with lyrics like, "Cowards don't play hockey." Tarasov's mashups of athletic and mental conditioning made his students see the world, the whole world, as relevant to hockey. Another freaky coach followed, Viktor Tikhonov, a Soviet army general who was known for his dictatorial style, ruthless 11-month-long practice regimens, and the hatred his players had for him. Out of this ice dojo arose a group of athletes that would go down in history as not just one of the world's best hockey teams, but one of the best sports teams of all time. They were called the Red Army. Here was their most famous starting lineup, known as the Russian Five. Vyacheslav Slava Fetisov, defenseman. Natural-born leader and decorated hockey god. Both charming and terrifying, quote, like a bear. Said to be one of the greatest players ever. Alexei Kasatinov, defenseman. Disciplined, patriotic, and unflinching. Fetisov's best friend on and off the ice. Vladimir Krutov, forward. Known as the Russian Tank. Standing 5'9" and weighing close to 200 pounds, Krutov was a beer keg on skates and the reliable soul of the team. Igor Larionov, center. Called the Professor. Larionov was cerebral, a tactician. Skinny and deceptively tough, his specialty was misleading opposing players. Sergei Makarov, forward. Makarov was a sniper, feared by goalies everywhere. He could find the back of the net from anywhere on the rink. They were backed up at the net by legendary goaltender Vladislav Tretiak, known for his stoicism and quick thinking. And this doesn't include the dozen other talented players in the club at a given time, each with his own fearsome quirks and specialties, such as longtime team captain Valery Vasilyev, who is known for punishing opponents while hungover from partying all night, and even once finishing a game after having a heart attack on the rink. You get the idea. They were monsters. But it wasn't just a stack of great individual players that made the Soviet team dominate. North American teams were known to scout young hockey players from junior leagues and groom them for the pros from absurdly young ages. Canadian pro hockey players tended to be flawless skaters with big muscles. During much of the Red Army's winning streak, Canada actually had players with better individual statistics on its national team, such as the legendary Wayne Gretzky. No, it was their style, the Russians insisted, that made their team special. No matter who was on the ice, opponents claimed the Red Army could read minds. It could be Fetisov and Kasatinov defending the net as one, Or champion center Sergei Fedorov circling the defense, distracting them while a teammate sliced in for a shot. Or in later years, it could be Vladimir the Impaler, Konstantinov, gliding through the enemy like a human spear, passing the puck between the opponent's legs. Regardless of the configuration, they were unstoppable. After losing the Canada Cup to them, Wayne Gretzky would tell Sports Illustrated that the Russians simply dismantled him. U.S. coaches would describe the Red Army as having a sixth sense and eyes in the back of their head. While Western hockey teams played aggressively, smashing into opponents like it was rugby, the Soviets performed a deadly ballet. They took a sport synonymous with beer and brawling and turned it into an art form. And here I have to pause. I have a confession to make. I'm not really into sports. Forgive me, Red Sox Nation. Put down your pitchforks, cheeseheads. You can blame my dad. He was an engineer, working in the sports-starved desert of southeast Idaho. I grew up thinking a wide receiver was something you plug into a radio. In my home, the game was never on. To this day, I rarely tune in to televised sports. Also, the old Soviet national hockey team footage is mesmerizing. Watching them play, sports fan or no, you just can't look away. They were so good that when Team USA narrowly beat them in the 1980 Olympics, the moment was declared a miracle on ice. It turns out that political skullduggery on ice would have been a more accurate description. While the win was certainly cathartic for America, the Russians essentially blew the game because of politics. USA's deciding goals happened after Coach Tikhonov pulled three Red Army players out of the game, including goaltender Tretiak, and replaced them with players from a KGB-sponsored hockey club in an attempt to score points with the Kremlin. And still the Soviets nearly won. Galvanized by that defeat, and vowing never to divide their team again, the Red Army reigned for the next 10 years. They won the gold in 1984 and 1988. They placed first in just about every other international championship, winning hundreds of games by embarrassing margins. The crew would go back-to-back years without losing a single match. And then the Cold War ended. The Iron Curtain fell. For years, the Soviet players had been paid peanuts, but now they were free to play for Western teams with real salaries. One by one, the stars of the Soviet national team left Russia to play for their former enemy, North America's very own National Hockey League. Fetisov and Kasatinov went to the Devils. Krutov and Larionov went to the Canucks. Makarov went to the Flames. Each was heralded as a hero that would change the franchise. And each sucked. None of the Russian Five's new teams won championships. Their stats tumbled. Many of the great Red Army players were older now, almost washed up. They didn't have the same chemistry with their new U.S. and Canadian teammates. Nothing like back home. Even when they ended up on teams stacked with hotshots, somehow they couldn't seem to win. And on the rare occasion they got teamed up with a fellow player from the old days, it made little difference. They still couldn't bring back that old magic. Tarasov's choreography and Tikhonov's discipline were no match for the ever larger and fiercer North American players. The Russians could adapt, but they couldn't compete like they used to. Team owners lost patience. Kasatinov got traded to the Blues, then the Ducks, then the Bruins. Makarov was traded to the Sharks. Fetisov went into a slump. In the old Soviet days, he was one of the top scorers in the world, but in New Jersey, he wasn't even near the top of his own team. Sports headlines, once jubilant about the Red Army coming to America, now sounded the alarm. Devils hit a drought in scoring, the New York Times lamented in 1992, noting that some saw a lack of teamwork at the root of the problem. Those magic years as impossible champions lasted longer than Fetisov or any of his comrades would have dreamed when they started out as kids. But like most such stories, the magic finally fizzled out. When Ronald Reagan referred to the Soviets as monsters, during the run-up to the 1980 presidential election, he wasn't talking about their hockey players. He was talking about the Soviet Union as a whole, as enemies whom the United States would make sure were, quote, destroyed with nuclear weapons, if it came to it. Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev wasn't talking about hockey either when he famously told Western diplomats, "We will bury you." For decades, those words reverberated across the Northern Hemisphere. So while Tarasov's budding young stars sang songs about hockey together, their peers in public schools sang about how to duck and cover under a desk if and when the bomb went off. When they traveled to America to slap around little rubber discs into little nets for crowds of beer guzzlers, their countries were busily manufacturing weapons of mass destruction. Though all those kids really wanted to do was play, hockey, like chess and space and all the other competitions, became a proxy fight for two countries who hated each other and their ideas. A fight that by all accounts could escalate to nuclear war and the end of civilization. Ironically, to develop the nuclear technology that their countries threatened each other with in the first place, scientists from Russia and America had to get along and collaborate with women and men from Germany and France and Poland and Britain and many other places. They built on each other's work, shared research and laboratories, and discovered how smashing atoms together created heat, which could make steam to turn turbines, which could make electricity. I was keen on this story growing up, because that engineering job my dad worked at in the Idaho desert happened to be a nuclear power plant. This is how the seed of science was planted in my little nerdy heart, leading me to pursue my career in science and technology journalism. I learned from a young age how the brilliant work of chemists, physicists, and electric engineers, and tinkerers of all kinds led us to figure out how to smash atoms together and harness the resulting heat to make electricity. And I learned that this was how every other breakthrough in history happened, from the steam engine to stuffed crust pizza, when humans put their heads together. Physically speaking, we're built for collaboration. Our brains are equipped for empathy. Our tongue and larynx can produce a range of sounds that put a dolphin to shame. The whites of our eyes are 3 times larger than those of other primates, helping us track what the other is looking at when words aren't possible. These features of body and brain raised us from a humble subtropical survivor to the global apex predator that built the pyramids, painted the Sistine Chapel, and filmed season 8 of Real Housewives of New Jersey. And yet, as the Cold War and every other reminiscent conflict between humans reminds us, there's a depressing side to our nature when we come together. Our brains are wired to collaborate, but also to be suspicious of other tribes, to bury those who don't look or think like us. And statistics show that working together is bound to be frustrating, even when we start off liking each other. As one famed organizational psychologist puts it, virtually all of the studies unambiguously reveal that individuals outperform teams in terms of both quantity and quality. We pull a little less hard on the tug-of-war rope when we're part of a crew than when we're by ourselves. We shout only 74% as loud in a group of 6 as we do alone, even when we think we're shouting our loudest. And we have repeatedly demonstrated that when we put people together to brainstorm, most groups will come up with fewer creative ideas and fewer good ones than the individual members of the group when they are allowed to brainstorm on their own. But the hard things in work and life often can't be done alone. We know that too. It takes 2 people to make a baby. It takes 12 to make a pro hockey team. It takes the work of hundreds to develop a scientific breakthrough like nuclear power, and thousands to operate a Fortune 500 company. It takes a gosh darn village to raise a child. Major progress requires major numbers of people working together. When we put our heads together, we hope we'll become better, not just bigger. But the reality is, we almost always don't. We have to fight against the inherent drag that comes with group work. And we end up fighting each other. Farm becomes fief. Polity becomes caste. We beat our plowshares into swords and turn nuclear energy into a bomb. And so, Team USSR and Team USA played hockey in the shadow of two giants with intercontinental ballistic missiles pointed at each other. Humans need to work together to accomplish anything big. But in our teams, our nations, our companies, and families, our collaborative efforts seem to move with all the thrilling speed of a glacier and often end in an avalanche of our own creation. And yet, occasionally, we experience an opposite phenomenon. Every once in a while, we encounter, or sometimes are lucky enough to be a part of, a magical moment when a group of people somehow becomes more than the sum of its parts. This is how breakthrough progress happens, from having a baby to harnessing the atom. On those rare occasions it happens to us, we feel limitless. Like the Soviet national hockey team felt during that brief and beautiful stretch of history before it all fell apart. In 1994, after the hockey players from the Soviet national team had aged over the hill or fallen out of the spotlight in the NHL, Scotty Bowman, the head coach of the Detroit Red Wings, began quietly gathering up the old Soviet national team players to his club. He recruited Fetisov, who was pushing old man status in sports terms at that point. He got Larionov in 1995. He picked up the young Soviet forward Vyacheslav Kozlov and snatched up comrade Konstantinov, the Impaler, along with Fedorov, whom the Red Wings had drafted a few years before. And rather than forcing a playbook on them, he stepped back. "I just let them do what they wanted to do," he said. In their first year, this reborn Russian Five won more games than any other team in the NHL. Larionov went from scoring 2 points the season before with the San Jose Sharks to 71 for the Red Wings. Fetisov tripled his total as well. Fedorov won a trophy. Suddenly, they were unstoppable again. The following year, the Red Wings won the Stanley Cup. And they won it again the next year. When documentarians asked Fetisov to describe what happened, he said, "Together again on the same team, it was like a fish put back in the water." This is a book about dream teams, about groups of people that make breakthroughs together. Like Fetisov and his fellow hockey players, they do the incredible against all probability. In the chapters ahead, we're going to meet one dream team after another. Creative agencies, rap groups, software companies, urban planners, social movements, and ragtag armies that pulled off amazing things together. We are going to uncover the secrets of individuals who make outstanding collaborators and look at what separates groups that simply get by together from groups that get better. And in examining the hidden psychology of great teams, I will argue that there's something wrong with the common wisdom about human collaboration and a way for us to harness our collective potential better than before. Our greatest moments in history, not just in sports, but in business and art and science and society, happened when humans defied the odds by coming together and becoming more than the sum of their parts. When they linked arms, stood on the metaphorical shoulders of the giants who came before them, and saw further together. Those old Soviet hockey players were that rare kind of team that turns the depressing truth about human chemistry on its head. Though they were each excellent players, the synergy that made them the best even after years apart and with a new American coach is not explained by skill or talent or practice time. Opposing teams had better player statistics. Other hockey players had practiced together as many years as the Russians had. But somehow, what Tarasov's kids had between them was special. There's science behind this kind of magic. Dream teams are not just random. They're the result of subtle interactions and ones that are not obvious. In recent years, we've made new discoveries in psychology and neuroscience that can help us unlock the magic that vaulted the Russian Five to greatness. And that science can help us work better together in any field. So what is that special sauce? What are those 11 secret herbs and spices that make some people more amazing together than apart? And conversely, What makes the teams of the most skilled and talented people on paper so often fail to exceed the sum of their parts in real life? What makes our society full of brilliant and hardworking and passionate people so capable of destroying itself when we have more resources and knowledge and technology and beauty between us than ever before? As we'll discover, the answers are often counterintuitive. The kinds of teams that change the course of history, that transform industries, break cycles of oppression or stagnation, or win hockey championships for decades in a row, are not the usual suspects. What makes them different lies beneath the surface. But once we understand how it works, the science of dream teams is something that we can apply to everything. From our personal relationships, to our everyday work, to our businesses and causes, to our communities, and to a world itself that desperately needs us to stop breaking down because of each other and start breaking through together. This book is about how that magic happens. Chapter 1. Buddy Cops and Mountaintops. Part 1. The Chicago detectives were in Baltimore, of all places, investigating a train robbery, of all things, when they learned about the plot to kill their hometown congressman. It was February and cold outside the office bearing the name John H. Hutchinson, stockbroker, on South Street near Baltimore's Inner Harbor. The office was a front, a temporary headquarters for agents of Hutchinson's private detective firm. The firm specialized in fraud and corporate espionage, particularly for clients who wanted to keep things quiet. Hutchinson's detectives had inhabited this secret office for several weeks now. They were there at the behest of the president of a local railroad company, a man named Samuel Felton. He'd hired them to look into a rumor about a plot to ruin him by disrupting millions of dollars of train cargo. Local politics were tense in Baltimore at the time, and Felton had feared, quote, an extensive and organized conspiracy that included members of the city police or even higher up. Paranoid as he was, Felton decided to hire outsiders to suss out whether the rumors had merit before involving authorities. And when it came to that sort of thing, Hutchinson was the best. A classic entrepreneur, he was a school dropout with a knack for solving puzzles. This led him to become a police detective, then to open a private firm. After 10 years in operation, Hutchinson still personally masterminded most high-profile jobs. And for the Baltimore Railroad case, he had also staffed his finest crew. Detective Webster was the principal investigator on the case. He was a tall, British immigrant, with curly hair and a beard that can best be described as hipster. Webster was tough and experienced and unafraid to kick down a door or jump from a moving train, as he once did while chasing a fleeing suspect. A family man with 4 kids, he'd earned his stripes as an NYPD officer for over a decade. Webster's counterpart, Detective Warren, on the other hand, was sly, charismatic, and 28 years old. Where Webster was a decisive man of action, Warren was the agency's smooth talker and master of disguise, thin and chameleon-like, with a knack for getting people to cough up information. The two had been chasing down Felton's railroad conspiracy at various Baltimore PD haunts for a month when they overheard a rumor that sent them racing back to base. In the course of that month, they had determined that a group of corrupt officials and politically disenfranchised socialites indeed had it out for Felton. But as far as they could tell, the group had done little but talk trash about him and other high-profile figures in Baltimore. Webster, who knew how to relate to police officers, had been buddying it up with off-duty drunks at local cop bars. Meanwhile, Warren was spending evenings in disguise at elite social hangouts, eavesdropping on the conversations of potential conspirators. In this manner, the two pieced together the troubling details of what was really afoot. Basically, it was terrorism. The group, frustrated at the state of national politics that they felt was leaving Baltimore behind, wanted to send a message. The government had failed. Look at our city, one conspirator confided, and tell me if we are not going to ruin. They'd considered several ways to draw attention to this point, like ruining Felton's railroad line. But the group had recently cooked up plans to do something much less subtle. Assassinate a high-profile congressman who would soon be passing through town. The congressman, a popular but polarizing Republican, was the perfect target. He represented everything these extremists hated about the current state of politics. They suspected that his death, while shocking, would spark the dialogue they desired. They'd then knock off Maryland's governor for good measure. Each would die as an example, one conspirator said, of a, quote, traitor to God and this country. The conspiracy reached high. A police captain named Ferrandini had vowed that the out-of-state congressman would die in this city. And Police Chief George Kane, who is sympathetic to the extremist cause, was willing to turn a blind eye. The congressman had made public plans to travel among the citizens by train from Illinois to Washington, with a series of speaking events scheduled en route. After stopping at Columbus, Pittsburgh, New York, Philadelphia, and Harrisburg, he would board a train to Baltimore. There a driver would take him to the Utah House, where he would deliver a short speech. After the speech, the driver would take him to a train station a mile away for a final leg to Washington, D.C. Although it's customary in America for local police to provide an armed escort for visiting politicians, often a showy spectacle of blocked roads and sirens, the plan was for Chief Kane to claim at the last minute that he couldn't spare any officers to meet the congressman's entourage at the train station. The man and his personal detail would be on their own. The conspirators would post agents along the route, sending word of the congressman's progress toward Baltimore. They had choreographed a street fight to break out as he passed through the vestibule at the train station to meet his driver. The fight would distract the transit security. Simultaneously, a mob of faux commuters would swarm the area. Several of these would be armed men, including at least one police officer, who would proceed to gun down the congressman and his entourage. When he reviewed Webster's and Warren's intel, Hutchinson spiraled into anxiety. This was much bigger than a railroad sabotage, indeed. They needed to alert some proper authorities. But how far up did the conspiracy go? Hutchinson sent Warren to alert the congressman and advise he go straight to Washington and skip the speaking tour. But the congressman deliberated. Given the current climate, canceling all these speeches could be politically disastrous. And tipping off the terrorists now would make them harder to catch later. Still, evidence of the murder plot was compelling. He asked Warren, could they discreetly get him to D.C. after his final event in Harrisburg and leave the authorities out of it? Hutchinson reluctantly agreed, understanding that any leak could hamper an investigation into the wider conspiracy. But he was nervous. This was not corporate espionage. It was life and death, and anyone could be a conspirator. Except for Mr. Felton, Hutchinson decided. He'd enlisted them to investigate these corrupt officials in the first place. He had to be clean. Now, it was their turn to enlist him. So, with Felton's help, the detectives devised a plan. On the night of the planned murder, after a packed speaking event in Harrisburg, the Republican from Illinois' 7th District excused himself to his hotel room. He donned the disguise that Warren had prepared for him, a felt hat and a slouchy overcoat, and exited the hotel alone through a back entrance. Hutchinson and a bodyguard met him there and accompanied him to the midnight train to Philly. Warren was waiting, having reserved a car for their, quote, family, whose, quote, invalid brother needed special assistance. While changing trains in Philadelphia, the disguised congressman stumbled through the station, playing the part of the disabled brother marvelously. The conspirators who camped out to alert the gang ahead didn't notice as the group crossed the station and boarded the next train to Baltimore. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, Hutchinson's crew were busy altering train routes. They'd secretly arranged for the earlier train to Baltimore to travel slower and along a sidetrack. This allowed the congressman's train to accelerate and arrive in Baltimore well ahead of schedule. They arrived early as planned. Again, no one noticed the invalid in the cowboy hat as he transferred with his family to an early train to D.C. Captain Ferrandini and his assassination gang were still waiting outside the Baltimore station as the train left for Washington. The disguised congressman passed through right under their noses. Detective Warren stayed awake all night as the train clattered past Fort Meade, Glendale, and Landover Hills. The congressman snoozed as his car crossed the Anacostia River and pulled into the station. Then he woke up and stepped out into the drizzly D.C. morning, where he, Abraham Lincoln, was inaugurated the 16th President of the United States. Part 2. We're going to start our adventure in the science of breakthrough teamwork with cops, small partnerships that have to solve big problems. Because what makes good police work work illustrates the foundational principle upon which dream teams operate. This will prepare us to explore all sorts of other kinds of teams, from bands to businesses to armies to social movements. The foiling of the Baltimore plot to assassinate Lincoln is an excellent case study for us to begin with. We had two groups of collaborators. One was outnumbered, outgunned, and out of time. The other was large, connected, and coordinated. Beating these odds required Hutchinson, Felton, Warren, and Webster to conduct a last-minute symphony, solving a series of problems in a variety of clever ways. They wore disguises, ferreted out the enemy's plans, and orchestrated delicate logistics to save a life, and potentially a nation. And they had to do it all in secret. In fact, even the name John H. Hutchinson itself was an alias. His real name is one you may have heard, Alan Pinkerton. After the Baltimore plot, Pinkerton's National Detective Agency became one of the most famous in history. Which reminds me, there's something else I need to tell you. There's something about that charismatic, disguise-loving 28-year-old whose work was instrumental to saving Lincoln's life that's germane to our exploration of breakthrough collaboration. It's something that will help us to understand the first and most fundamental component of dream teams. It's that if you're like most people, you probably thought Detective Warren was a man. But she wasn't. Part 3. J. Edgar Hoover. Let us face reality. If the credibility of the FBI is to be maintained in the eyes of the public, the lawbreaker, fugitive, deserter, etc., and if we are to continue to be a flexible, mobile, ready-for-anything force of special agents, we must continue to limit the position to males. March 11th, 1971. Part 4. Kate Warren was the first female detective we know about in U.S. history. But it took a long time for there to be many more. Women weren't allowed to join police departments until 30 years after the Baltimore plot. It wasn't until even later that police departments assigned any women to be detectives. And the FBI didn't hire a single female agent until 1972. The ranks of women law enforcement agents did not swell, in America at least. At the time of this writing, only 15% of active duty police officers identified themselves as women. And women made up just 20% of FBI agents. This is despite what retired FBI agent and University of Northern Florida professor Ellen Glasser points out. Half of criminal justice students in college are women. The common explanation for why is a simple one, as another former FBI agent put it to me. Generally speaking, women do not have the same strength as men. For better or worse, this is a biology thing, not an equality thing. The Centers for Disease Control's most recent data found that 89% of adult men are stronger than 89% of adult women. The Journal of Applied Physiology reports that men have an average of 40% more upper body strength than women. And if two random strangers of the opposite sex decide to have a leg-kicking contest on the street, there's only a tiny chance that the woman will win. Since you're listening to this in audio form, I'm just going to describe the charts that you can't see. For this one, just imagine a big nasty graph with lots of dots representing grip strength. The dots representing men's grip strength are higher at every age than the women, except for around age 5, when girls used to beat me up. There's also one dot that makes it clear that there's some ultra-scary 37-year-old guy out there somewhere. Genetics say that women are not going to be as good at chasing bad guys, punching bad guys, or intimidating bad guys with their size. That's one of the reasons that FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover didn't let women become agents at all. Quote, "The special agent, in his appearance, approach, and conduct, must create the impression to his adversary that among other qualities he is intrepid, forceful, aggressive, dominant, and resolute," Hoover wrote. The other reason for excluding females was unity. Hoover's army of agents needed to march to the same beat to be an effective team. "We must put up the best front possible," he explained. And you know what? That's okay. Turns out that some jobs, like law enforcement, are just better suited for men. Kate Warren was nothing but a rare anomaly of a female on a law enforcement dream team. She is by far the exception to the rule. Except it turns out that Hoover was wrong, and all that stuff in those last two paragraphs I just said is garbage. The story of FBI Special Agent Chris Jung and a Newark mafia boss shows us why. Part 5. The morning sun reflected off the garbage floating in the bend of the Passaic River that formed the city limits of Newark, New Jersey. Horns blared and street hustlers hustled as bell-bottom commuters poured into the cluster of office buildings on the river's western shore. Inside one of those buildings, agents from the FBI were planning a raid. Well, sort of. They were planning something. They weren't sure what. Newark, in the 1970s, was run by syndicates of a handful of Italian-American crime families. The Lucchese family was known for controlling the newspaper delivery and kosher meat unions. The Genovese family was famous for its founder, Lucky Luciano. And then, of course, there was the De Cavalcante crime family, whose de facto boss is said to be the basis for the character Tony in HBO's The Sopranos. They controlled the city's gambling parlors, its piers, its garbage collection, and its murder. Mafia bosses are hard to get into a courtroom. But in the spring of 74, the FBI had dug up some dirt involving one of the big bosses. The FBI agents I interviewed were willing to tell me this story, but not the name of which mob boss it was. So we'll just call him Mr. Lombardi. The dirt was dirty enough to subpoena Lombardi, or force him to appear in court to testify. But there was a problem. The law required that subpoenas be delivered in person, by hand. Once you receive the subpoena, you're required by law to appear in court, or you could be arrested. And if you were a mob boss who appeared in court, you were suddenly in a lot of danger. Of saying something you shouldn't, or worse, of another mobster getting worried that you were going to. The mob had figured out by this time that one of the best ways to stay out of prison, or the Passaic, was to avoid being summoned to court in the first place. If a subpoena never got delivered, it couldn't be enforced. So they developed a simple but effective strategy. Surround the boss with enough layers of bodyguards that no cop could ever talk to him in person. Thus, the Newark crime heads of the 1970s were able to move about town in style, and yet remain untouchable. Lombardi knew the FBI would love to see him in court, so his operation kept special track of the agents in Newark's organized crime squad. And anyone a mafia guard didn't know would get stopped upon approach until identity was verified and permission granted. Agents at the Bureau had been scratching their heads for weeks about how to get close enough to Lombardi to deliver the subpoena. They'd tried ambushing him while he was out at lunch, but bodyguards had blocked the way. They needed a better plan. A dozen special agents and the supervisor of the organized crime squad had convened in a war room to brainstorm new ideas. They'd decided that there needed to be some sort of raid. Problem is that a subpoena is a request, not an arrest. You can't really deliver a subpoena at gunpoint, because you can't shoot someone for preventing you from delivering paperwork. Around and around the agents went. Every idea for how to coerce, intimidate, or blast their way past Lombardi's bodyguards was a no-go. That's when the rookie from another department, Chris Jung, raised her hand. The organized crime squad had invited her as a guest because they were out of ideas. They were willing to consider almost anything at this point. The male agents turned their heads when she spoke up. Mr. Lombardi's daughter is getting married in 2 weeks, she pointed out. And that gave her an idea. 2 weeks later, a chauffeured black car pulled up to the wedding palace where the Lombardi family was celebrating their daughter's reception. Out of the car stepped an elegant woman in heels and a purple high-necked gown. The security guards couldn't help but notice Miss Jung as she walked confidently into the reception hall. Like she had predicted in that squad meeting, the guards did nothing to stop her. That a gorgeously dressed woman like her might be a federal agent occurred to no one on an occasion like this. None of the staff questioned whether she'd been invited. Once inside, the job was simple. Jung made a beeline to the front of the reception line, where the happy couple and their families greeted guests. The bride looked beautiful. Next to her, the father of the bride, Mr. Lombardi himself, beamed. Until Jung stepped in front of him and handed him the subpoena papers. "Enjoy your night," she said. The man stared at her as she turned and walked out. As she exited the building, the mob boss began to howl. The chauffeur, a fellow special agent, was waiting with the engine running. "I think I ruined the wedding," Jung said. "Anticlimactic?" "Yes. But that, it turns out, is key." Part 6. Here's a statistic that might surprise you. Women make up 12% of American cops, but only 2% of police shootings. Curiously, this doesn't seem to lower the success rates of female officers. Cop for cop, women seem to be just as good at stopping crimes as men. It's just that female cops are 6 times less likely to shoot someone. Even more dramatic, female officers are 8 times less likely to use excessive force than male officers, according to studies by the National Center for Women in Policing. Police partnerships with female officers in them make fewer mistakes and, on average, solve problems with less collateral damage. Wearing a fancy dress to deliver a subpoena doesn't sound nearly as exciting as a SWAT team raid. Neither does putting a floppy hat on a congressman for a midnight train ride. But both of our stories about female crime fighters erode a common misconception about law enforcement, that the job is about bullets and muscle. It turns out that fighting crime usually isn't about fighting at all. We could cherry-pick all sorts of anecdotes about times when the day was saved by cops literally punching people, as television often depicts, but what happened in the case of the FBI and Mr. Lombardi is how it works most of the time. The nature of the work, says former FBI Assistant Director Janice Fedarsik, is primarily about good judgment and problem-solving skills. And according to FBI reports, women in police departments and intelligence bureaus are on average more successful than men at de-escalating dangerous situations without the use of force. All of this begs a couple of questions, however. If it's true that law enforcement is about good judgment and problem solving, why would women tend to screw up less than men? Men are intelligent too. Furthermore, if it's true that women do so well at this kind of work, why do we still have so few female law enforcement agents? It turns out that both of these questions have the same answer. On former U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, Assistant Director Kathleen Kiernan's office desk sits a closed padlock. It's there for an analogy she's used hundreds of times when explaining why women succeed in law enforcement. If she hands you the padlock and asks you to break into it, she says that more often than not, quote, men will figure out how to tactically compromise it, break it, subvert it, all those kinds of things. But instead of trying to physically tackle the lock, she says, most women will initially try to find the key or figure out a way to psychologically compromise the person who has it. And this, Kiernan insists, is the way most women in law enforcement work. Most of them haven't spent their lives assuming they can default to muscles to solve problems, so they use tools like negotiation and communication before they resort to force. And often, that turns out to be a better way. This is the same reason, by the way, that studies show that despite tending to have less upper body strength, women tend to make better rock climbers than men. During her 30 years at the NYPD, Denise Thomas, one of the first black women to become a Brooklyn homicide detective, was revered by fellow cops. She policed high school violence, solved decades-old murder cases, and busted bad guys in the Marcy Projects back when Jay-Z was there selling crack. And most of the time, she told me, it was psychological work. Quote, you have to have a knack for dealing with people, she says. The job is not to fight, but to disarm the fight. You have to defuse the situation and talk them down, she says. Agent after agent, cop after cop, told me variations on this same theme. As a young local police officer, Vidarsik told me, it became clear to her that because women do not have the same upper body strength as men, I had to develop my communication skills to learn to deflate a situation that could escalate. Think back to Chris Jung and the mob boss. The male agents went in circles, trying to come up with ways to barge their way through Mr. Lombardi's bodyguards. And Jung put on a ball gown and walked right in. It was an obvious strategy in retrospect, but it never occurred to the men. To the one woman in the room, it was a no-brainer. So why don't more women make the leap from criminal justice school to law enforcement? Some said the reason was women don't think they're going to be able to beat men up. Others said women dislike the boys' club culture that surrounds law enforcement or the violent ethos of American law enforcement generally. But not being able to beat men up is also exactly what helps women to fight crime smarter. And that's not because female officers are bad with guns. In fact, during the Lombardi case, Jung happened to be the number one marksman in the FBI. She was the first to get a perfect score on the FBI's timed firearms test and became the head firearms instructor for the Bureau. Also, at the time I interviewed her, Jan Fedarsik held the record of the highest-ranking female FBI agent ever. Before we keep going, we need to step back for a second and note that these statistics we've been discussing about men and women are true in general, but not of every individual out there. Many women are terrible negotiators. And many male officers are thoughtful, non-aggressive communicators who would never punch a pillow. We're not saying that one's gender will mean that one has the characteristics we're discussing. We're just saying that they will be much more likely to than not. Gender, in this case, is proxy for probability. But as we'll soon see, predicting behavior from demographics is not the most important thing afoot here. Despite being such a good marksman, in Jung's mind, firearms were simply part of a larger strategic toolkit. Quote, we probably are more prone to pull a gun than a man would be, Jung says, but not necessarily to use it. While I was interviewing all these detectives about their teamwork dynamics, American newspaper headlines were reporting a depressing amount of police violence. Good cops were being killed. Bad cops were killing unarmed people. Race and hate were often factors in both. The country was experiencing a backlash to a state of overreach, and good people on both sides of the badge were suffering. In this violent context, everything we've explored so far leads to an inevitable conclusion. If we want to do a better job at law enforcement and reduce violence, the simplest solution is to make all of our law enforcement officers women. All indications say that crime-fighting organizations would get better if they got rid of the men. Except no. If we did that, it turns out we'd have another problem. Part 7. Pretend that you're having a housewarming party, and you've invited your 8 best friends. You've baked a delicious round cake, and because you love your friends equally, you want to cut it into 8 equal pieces for them. But there's a catch. The knife that you're using, for whatever reason, is going to break after you make 3 cuts. So how do you slice the cake into 8 equal pieces in just 3 moves? If you're like most people, you probably first cut the cake in half vertically, then you cut it in half horizontally, and then, again, if you're like most people, you'll start making a third and final cut diagonally before realizing that this only makes 6 slices of cake. So what do you do? At this point, you might try to get fancy and diagram out some funny-looking cake slices, but then you'll remember that the pieces have to be equal for your friends to know that you love them the same. There is a simple answer, though. It just requires changing your point of view. The solution is to go ahead and make the first two cuts, creating four slices of cake, and then to turn your head and look at the cake sideways and cut it all the way through. This little puzzle illustrates something important. It shows us, in a very literal way, a simple truth, that sometimes the best way to solve a problem requires looking at it from a different angle. In other words, to change perspective. In technical terms, perspective is the way we map the world around us to our internal language. For example, when a geologist hears the word rock, her perspective might make her first think of something different from when a teenager hears the word rock. In less vocabulary-centric terms, perspective is the angle from which we consider things. Perspective is built by how we uniquely experience the world. A bystander who sees a building on fire might perceive what's happening very differently from a firefighter or from a person who once had his house burned down. When you ask tall people what makes for a good airline, most of them will tell you legroom, while short people will tell you elbow room. Neither answer is incorrect, in this case, depending on whether you see the world from 6 inches higher off the ground. Perspective is one dimension of every person's mental toolkit. To introduce the other dimension, we return to our housewarming party for another puzzle. Pretend that next to the cake at your kitchen table are 6 glasses lined up in a row. The first 3 glasses are full of milk. The next 3 are empty. Now say I asked you to move the glasses so that the full and empty cups alternate. But there's a catch. You can only move 1 glass. Can you do it? For most people, this one is a bigger head scratcher than the cake. Most of us try to move the 2nd glass of milk to sit in between 2 empty glasses, only to realize that it still leaves 2 full glasses next to each other. If you're still stumped, try this. Pretend that I asked you to solve this same puzzle, but that I also told you to pretend that you had to use the technique of a chemist to do it. If you were stumped before, at this point the answer may have suddenly become obvious. Pour the milk from the 2nd glass into the 2nd-to-last glass and put the glass back. This puzzle helps us to understand the second dimension of a person's mental toolkit, something called heuristics. If perspective is how we see a problem, heuristics are how we go about solving it. You can think of heuristics as rules of thumb or problem-solving strategies. The way a chemist's brain instinctively attempts the milk puzzle is likely going to be different than the way, say, a forklift operator's brain does. This isn't to say that forklift operators wouldn't be able to solve the milk puzzle. What it says is that if you move objects around all day with a forklift, your first strategy for rearranging glasses of milk is likely going to be different than if your job is to pour liquids in and out of containers all day. These two parts of our mental toolkit, perspective and heuristics, go hand in hand, and they explain what's actually important when it comes to working together in law enforcement, and what's really at play in our study of gender in cops. To understand what I mean, picture in your head a mountain range. Imagine that it has peaks of varying heights with one really big one in the middle and little ones on the sides. This mountain range represents the set of potential solutions to a hypothetical problem. Each peak represents a different solution. The higher the peak, the better the solution. Every problem in life or work can be represented by its own unique mountain range like this, with varying quality of solutions. As you can imagine, some solutions to our hypothetical problem are not as good as others. And in this case, there is one best solution, the highest peak in the middle of our imaginary mountain range. Unfortunately, when we're exploring real problems, it is as if we're hiking through fog. We can't actually see the entire mountain range. This means that when we find a peak, a solution that works, we don't know if we're at the top of the range or just the top of one mountain. We have to decide whether to continue exploring for a better solution. And here's where our cake analogy comes back. Where we start out on the mountain and what part of it we can see depends on our perspective. It's like getting dropped off by helicopter at a particular spot on the range. Now that we're here, we need a strategy or a heuristic to help us explore for solutions. Let's say you have one mountain heuristic, and it is to march in one direction until the mountain